If you could have a conversation with anyone in history, what would you ask them?
Hello, General Washington. Good day, Miss Tubman.
I had to know, so I decided, let's give him a call.
Welcome to the Calling History Podcast.
Welcome back to part two of Sacagawea. In the last episode, she talked about her kidnapping at 12 years old, and she explained why she was so careful not to show her emotions to her kidnappers and even her husband that either purchased her or won her in a poker game. In the next episode, you're going to hear about how she reacted when the boat tipped over and all the journals and the equipment on the expedition were going to be lost. I'll give you a hint. It was the exact opposite reaction that her cowardly husband had. She'll also give you flash flood tips when you're in a foreign land and have a baby in one arm. And finally, she'll finish with a story that's been passed down from her Shoshone family about how the coyote brought fire to man. Well, that raises an interesting question for me. When you have your different tribes, okay, so we've talked about the Hidatsus, and then, of course, the Shoshones. If the Hidatsus picked one spot of land and they started farming there, and they built those earthen homes that they lived in, I am guessing that if your people just decided to walk through that area, that the Hidatsus would have defended that area that they were on. Because they were saying, look, no, we put down homes here. This is our place.
But we wouldn't do that.
Who wouldn't do that?
It's not like we would go to the Hidatsa village where these people are living and we wouldn't say, get out, we're taking this over now. We just wouldn't do that. And also in the Hidatsa village that we were living in, it was the Hidatsa and the Mandan tribes. Those two tribes came together and they shared that land and they lived together. But it's not that anyone said, you have to get out. This is ours now. How would you feel if you had a home and someone came to you and said, I just bought that from your neighbor and now it's mine, get out?
It's painful to think about because you're 100% right. And yet, that's exactly what the white people are doing when they're coming across and they buy this land from Napoleon and then just tell everybody that has been there their whole lives, get out. It's exactly what they're doing.
I heard that there were other nations, like there was the French with Napoleon, there were Spanish people. I don't know what that means, but I know it's other people, and I know that Spanish is another language. And they just kept saying that you own it now, the Spanish, or the French own it, or they called them the Americans. I just don't understand that. I don't understand. And then this great Father Jefferson who sent them, that was one of the things that they traded. They gave people, it was like this thing made out of metal. It was on something that they would put around your neck, like a necklace. And on one side of this metal, it had a picture of the great Father Jefferson. And on the other side, it had two people like shaking hands to show peace. And so when we would go on the trip and they would meet other nations, they would give them this necklace. And then they would say things like, Great Father Jefferson is in charge now, and you should only trade with us. You should not trade with the Spanish or anyone else or the French, because we own this now. And I don't know, it was just very strange to me. Who is this great Father Jefferson? And then they would find animals and plants and they would send them back to the great Father Jefferson because they came across so many things that they had never seen before. And I always wondered if we would ever meet this great Father Jefferson, but I guess not. And then this really made me angry, but I didn't show it because when we were by the ocean, there was this visiting chief who came, and this chief had this robe of sea otter skins, and Monsieur Clark loved this robe of sea otter skins, so he wanted to trade with this chief, give him something, and then the chief would give Monsieur Clark this sea otter skin robe. It was so beautiful. So he offered him all of these things, but the chief did not want any of the things that Monsieur Clark was giving him. He wanted this blue beaded belt that I was wearing. I always wore this belt. And he wanted my belt for this sea otter skin robe. And I had to give it to them. They wanted it. And so I took it off and I gave it to them. I did not want to give it to them, but what choice did I have? And so I gave it to them. And I don't know, the next day they gave me this blue coat to repay me for the belt. But I wish I did not have to give them my blue beaded belt.
And this belt you'd had your whole life, and they just wanted to get this otter skin coat, and that was it. They just take it from you like it's theirs.
Well, yes. They wanted it, and I had to give it to them. I don't know what they would have done if I would have said no. But I knew better than to say anything. And even though I was sad, I knew not to show any emotion. I suppose it was nice that they gave me this blue coat to repay me for the belt, but what choice did I have?
Yeah, it's very considerate of you to say it was nice, but it doesn't sound very nice listening to it as you say it. It sounds really disrespectful and rude, especially how much you were sacrificing to help them on their journey. Let's go back for a minute. So when you're talking about Lewis and Clark recruiting Charbonneau for this journey, mm-hmm. how did that actually begin? Where did they meet him or meet you? I know eventually they just grabbed you and said, you're coming. I actually thought initially they were negotiating with you. They were discussing terms with you, but he just brought you along, it sounds like. What were the terms? What did Charbonneau want to go on this journey?
Well, because we didn't live in the village, we lived outside the village, but Charbonneau would trade. He would come into the village a lot and trade. And so he heard that these two men were there and that they were looking for guides to help them get over the mountains. Now, Charbonneau, he knew the mountains, not all of them all the way across, but he knew that. And he wanted to get in because he heard that they were going to pay him money, a lot of money. And so he went to the village. Both Otter Woman and I went with Charbonneau to the village, and he met Monsieur Lewis and Monsieur Clark, and he presented them with, what did we give them? We gave them buffalo robes or something. He brought them presents, and he told them that he was interested in going. And it was strange because Lewis and Clark, they did not speak French. Charbonneau did not speak English, but there was another Frenchman there who spoke French and English. So Charbonneau spoke to the Frenchman in French, and then the Frenchman would talk to Lewis and Clark in English, and then Lewis and Clark would speak English back to the Frenchman, then he would tell Charbonneau in French what they said. And it was like that on the whole trip. There were so many languages, and it was a chain of languages. And so Charbonneau told him that he wanted to come, and he said, when he found out that they wanted to trade with the Shoshone for horses, Charbonneau pushed me forward and said, she speaks Shoshone, she should come. And they're like, oh, she speaks Shoshone? That's good.
And that was it. You were on your way.
That's how it happened.
So one of the things as I was reading about you, because there's not a lot written from your perspective, but when you were kidnapped, you were in a place that we now call Idaho, and you were taken way over to the east to live with the Hidatsus, which I can't remember what state that is right now.
I think it's a state that they call North Dakota.
Right. Yes. North Dakota. Exactly. Now, when you find out that you're going on this trip and they need you to speak Shoshone, you're not going on this trip you're going because they told you to, but also this really is a trip for you to, for the first time in years, to go home and see your people, right?
I did think that maybe I would see my people. I was excited. I might see my mother. From what they said, we were going to pass right through where the Shoshone, my Shoshone, were. And so I was excited, and I was so hoping to see my family.
And after traveling for days and days, I don't know, maybe months, I don't know how long it was, did you eventually get back to your village?
Well, we had climbed this mountain, and then we got to this area where it's called the Great Falls. Like, once we started going across the Rocky Mountains, mm-hmm. and there were these Great Falls where there were five enormous waterfalls. I almost died, but we got around the Great Falls. And when we got through there, all of a sudden we were traveling. And this is so strange. We were at the Three Forks River, And that is exactly where I was captured so many years ago when I was 12 winters. We got there and I recognized that. That was where I was captured. So I knew that we were close to where my people were. And then shortly after that, we kept walking. We got to this high point where I looked and I remembered this high point was called, I called it as a child, Beaver's Head, because it looked like a beaver's head. And I knew that was not far from my people, the Shoshone, where they stay after winter. And I knew that it was either this river or the next one where I would be home. And oh, Monsieur Clark and Monsieur Lewis, they really wanted to get the horses before winter so that we could get across the mountains before winter. And I was the only person on that journey who spoke Shoshone. And so I knew that they would take me into the village to talk to the people, to ask for horses and guides and supplies. And I knew, I was so excited because the Beaver's Head, that was so close to where my people were. But then we stopped and we made camp and they were going to go ahead to see if they could find any people. And I so wish that we weren't in that camp, that I wanted to go. I wanted to go. It was this river or the next. I could see my family. I hadn't seen them in 3 or 4 winters. I was almost home, that word, home. And eventually they came back to where we had made camp and they said that they had come across some Shoshone and I recognized the moccasin prints because everybody makes different sorts of moccasins, but I recognized that. And so then they took me to the Shoshone village and I began to dance and jump for joy and I started to suck my fingers because that's a sign that means these are my people. And then Jumping Fish saw me. I saw her and she ran to me and we embraced and I saw other women that I knew when I was a child and they came to embrace me and I was so happy. I wanted my mother, but before I could ask for that, they took me into this teepee of the chief and I heard his voice and I saw his face and I began to cry. I ran to him and I covered him with my blanket because it was my brother.
Your brother was the chief?
It was Kamiawait. He was now the leader of our nation, and I hadn't seen him in so many years. That was my very own brother. And I put the blanket over our heads, and he embraced me, and I was crying. And then he told me that we were the last because the rest of our family was gone. They were dead.
Ooh.
I would never see my mother again. She would never meet my son. For now, I have my brother and my childhood friends, and that was enough. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, I appreciate you telling me, but what happened to them all?
I don't know. I really didn't get to ask to get that information because Monsieur Lewis and Monsieur Clarks wanted to negotiate for the horses and the guides. And the chain of languages took forever, you know, English to French to Hadatsa to Shoshone, back to Hadatsa to French, back to English. It took forever. And then gifts were given and pipes were smoked. But I had to be there the whole time because they needed my language. And so eventually my brother gave them horses and old Toby's sons as guides. And across the mountains we would go.
When you say old Toby and his sons, is old Toby a person?
Yes, that's what they called him. That wasn't his native name. I don't know what his Shoshone name was, but that's what they called him. I never knew old Toby, but he was the one who was going to be the guide across the mountains.
And they just joined the expedition?
Yes.
Okay, so why are the Shoshone giving up all these horses? What does the Lewis, the expedition that you're on, what do they have to give them in return? Or are they just doing it out of the kindness of their heart?
Oh, no, it's always about trading. They gave them kettles. They gave them some of those metals to put on their neck, like that had the picture of the great father, Jefferson. They gave them blankets. They gave them lots of things. They gave them tobacco. And they gave them guns.
Did they trade them for guns? Did they give them guns for the horses?
They gave them some guns. Yes, they did.
Once somebody has the guns, everybody wants the guns.
Well, I don't like guns.
Me either.
I don't like that because to me, guns mean death. but they gave them all sorts of things. They gave them this strange thing. They called it a looking glass. It was flat and shiny. And when you look at it, you can see yourself. You could see yourself in sometimes the reflection, sometimes on the mountains where it was shiny, or in the river. But these things were very strange. They also gave them axes and brass kettles, all sorts of things. They gave them calico, which is a shirt made out of this, I don't even know what it is, but they traded a lot of things, knives, because the Shoshone didn't know how to make things like metal things. But the white man knew how to do that. That's how they made like kettles and knives and things like that, fish hooks. So they did, there was a lot of trading, and I don't remember how many horses they gave them, but it was a lot of horses. And that was one of the things that the Shoshone, we were known for horses. We knew how to breed horses and we had horses. So that was one of the things that we gave.
Now that you're back at your home, but everybody that you love, unfortunately, has passed, and your brother's in charge of the tribe, so he's probably, if he's in charge of the Shoshone Nation, he's probably too busy to be a brother. He's probably has a lot of responsibilities, I'm guessing.
Yes.
And why didn't you stay? It's still your tribe. It's still your home, right?
I thought about that, but I guess I had a sense of adventure in me because I had heard about the ocean, which is like a river, only I had come all this way. I wanted to see it. And then I thought maybe on the way back, I might stay, but I don't know. It was hard. I don't think Charbonneau would let me, for one. And I was a mother now, and I don't know. I don't know why I didn't just say I'm staying. I don't know if Charbonneau would have let me stay. And I didn't speak up.
As a mother to Pomp, and a wife to Charbonneau, what do you think the consequences would have been if you had just said to your brother, I don't want to leave. I don't want to go with this man. I want to raise my child, Shoshone, and I need you to protect me. If you had said that, what would your brother have said?
I don't know.
You feel like it was just past that point where there was an option of that to happen?
I think so, because I had a child. And I don't know if he would have said, this man and your child, that's your new family. I don't know if he would have said that. I don't know.
It's incredible that when you got back, you found jumping fish right away.
I
wonder why she didn't go on the expedition with you.
I don't think they wanted anyone else. And she had a family. She can't just leave, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense. Right. They're not exactly recruiting more women to go on the trip.
No, I think they probably thought one was enough.
So now you decide that you're leaving and you start heading towards the ocean. And when you're on this trip, and I don't know if it happened before or after, but I have to believe that somewhere along the way you're running into, you'd mentioned grizzly bears. I imagine you're running into dangerous animals or animals that scared you in some way. Is there anything? You do have something to say about that. Well, tell me, what's your experience with that?
Oh, well, we had told Monsieur Lewis and Clark about these bears. I don't think they believed that these bears were as scary as they really turned out to be. The Mandans, I know, told them about the size of the bear, but I don't think they believed it till they saw it for themselves. In fact, one time, there was a bear that came after Monsieur Lewis, and he jumped in the river to get away from the bear, but bears can swim. And this bear jumped in the river and was coming after them. They were surprised at the size and the strength and the speed of this bear.
Lewis is running from a bear?
He jumped in the river. And they were surprised, and they're firing their guns. It took much use of their guns to kill that bear. You could shoot the bear, and the bear got it in like the arm or something, and the bear would keep coming. Those bears would keep coming. I don't remember who it was who said that they'd much rather fight two men than one bear, because the bear, it took much use of their guns to kill that bear, and they knew to watch out for these dangerous bears that they called grizzly.
Yeah, sounds terrible.
Eventually, they could shoot the bear and the bear would die, but it was better not to come across this bear. Oh, the other creature that we came across that was, this one maybe was even worse, was mosquitoes.
One's definitely bigger than the other, that's for sure. Did you not have mosquitoes where you were from?
Not like this. There were so many of them. We often had to move our camps to escape from them. There were so many. The sky would be black with so many of them. They flew into our eyes. They bit everyone. We could not even eat without mosquitoes flying into our mouth. We would build big smoky fires to keep the mosquitoes away. And we would put nets over our beds or blankets over our heads. Or sometimes we would burn cedar bark or dried orange peels to keep them away. But there was no way to keep them from us. My poor son, he was bitten, his face puffed up. And so finally someone found that we could put some sort of lard on our skin that smelled. Oh, it was awful, but it helped keep the mosquitoes away. It was, oh, those mosquitoes were just terrible.
So you've got grizzly bears and swarms of attacking mosquitoes.
Yes.
Anything else that you're running from? Because the adventure part of this, getting to the ocean, does sound like a lot of fun. It sounds wonderful, a lot of work, but wonderful. But what you're describing right now just sounds awful.
Well, there was something that did help us. Monsieur Lewis had a dog. His name was Seaman, and he was so large. He was about the size of a small grizzly bear, this dog. And one time, this one chief offered Monsieur Lewis 3 beaver pelts for that dog, but Monsieur Lewis said, no, that was a good dog. He saved our lives once when a bison came rampaging through the camp. And if not for Seaman the dog, people would have been trampled. But Seaman, he was a big dog, and he barked, and he chased the bison away. He also barked sometimes, and he would scare off grizzly bears, and he would keep watch if a moose was at the camp. And Seaman the dog, he could also swim. He would jump into the river, and he could catch squirrels and bring them to us for dinner. He could catch geese and pronghorns and goats and deer. He was a good dog, but he did not like the mosquitoes. When they would come for him, he would howl. But he was a very good dog, and we were lucky to have him help us.
Was that Lewis's dog?
Yes.
Seaman sounds like a great dog.
Oh, but one time, well, when winter was there, and it was so cold, and when food was so scarce, the Nez Perce, they came, and they gave us dogs as food.
Ugh.
And the people, we were so hungry. Of course, everybody would eat it. But Monsieur Lewis would not eat a dog.
You just said Nez Perce, and that was another tribe, is what you're saying?
Yes, that we came across.
And were they decent people? Were they?
They were very nice to us because we had been crossing the mountains, and the snow was up to our knees, and we were so cold, and oh, we had never been this cold, and there were no roots or berries to gather, and animals were scarce, and we came across a Nez Perce tribe, and they gave us fish and berries and dogs to eat. They were so nice, and yes, they were very wise, and they knew the mountains. When we were coming back, after we had gotten to the ocean, the Nez Perce, they gave us guides to get us back across the mountains to head back home, and a trip that took like 11 days with the Nez Perce, because they knew where they were going, they knew the mountains, it took like 6 days instead of taking so many days. The Nez Perce were very good. But I don't know, maybe we really didn't have trouble with any of the tribes that we would come across. And I think that was thanks to me, because when they would see this group of men traveling with a woman and a baby, they knew it wasn't a war party. Because you did not bring a woman and a baby to fight.
Well, there it is. The question that I've always been wondering. Here you are traveling across all of this land for so many years this trip took. And you're passing several different tribes. And I have to believe there are other tribes like the Hidatsu that would grab somebody if they wanted them. Or maybe kill somebody if they didn't like them or didn't know them. And why is it that nobody ever killed everybody on this expedition? And it was because of you. Because if there's a woman there holding a baby, nobody's thinking that this is a group of warriors. That's what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. They just, because they don't bring a woman and a baby to a war party, they knew that we came in peace and that they knew that we came to trade. I wonder if Monsieur Lewis knew that was how it would be when he decided to bring me along on this adventure. He never said, but I wonder if in addition to me speaking Shoshone, if he knew.
There is no doubt in my mind about one thing, and that is, I don't know if he knew that in advance. If he did, then he is a very strategic thinker, if either of those thought that, because I think they would have been thinking about guns and weapons and food and water. But if somebody thought that out in advance, now that I think about this, I feel like I can comfortably say that there is a 0% chance that anybody on that expedition would have lived through that had you not been sitting on the boat with a baby next to you.
I think that's true, because they knew you don't travel with a woman and a baby. So they were lucky to have me.
Thank you for that revelation, because I never could understand that, and now it is crystal clear. You were the most important person on those boats. And as you were traveling, were you running across a lot of things that you hadn't seen before? Different animals, different roots or plants or anything?
Well, it's things that I was familiar with, but they were not. Monsieur Lewis and Monsieur Clark and all of the men on their corps of discovery had never seen many of the plants they came upon. They had never seen a plant called echinacea, which treats snake bites, but they didn't know that. They had never seen sunflowers, which is a wonderful food that the Shoshone eat. They had never seen cottonwood trees that they felled and used to build their canoes. And there were so many more plants that were food, medicine, and beauty that they had never seen. And so they would keep some of these plants, and they also came across animals that they didn't know of. So they would keep some of the animal skins and the skeletons, and they would draw pictures of these plants and animals that they had never seen. They had never seen a pronghorn, which is like an antelope. They had never seen a prairie dog, which is like a squirrel with no tail and digs holes rather than climb trees. They had never seen a jackrabbit. They had never seen a coyote. I could not believe they had never seen a coyote, because coyote is important to the Shoshone. Coyote is in many of our stories, and stories are how we pass the time on a cold winter night. We tell stories. Stories teach us about our history, our culture, our land, our people. We tell stories in our prayers and through our songs and dances. Some of our stories tell how Wolf made the land with a ball of mud, and Coyote created the people who jumped from a water jug. Coyote is a trickster, but he can also be a great spirit and a provider to us. Like when Coyote brought fire to the people. Oh, can I tell you the story about how Coyote brought fire to the people?
Yes, please.
Many winters ago, the people had no fire to keep warm and cook food. Many people died in the cold of winter. The people were so cold, and we had not enough things to keep us warm. But animals, now animals had no need of anything to keep them warm. They had their fur, but people did not have fur. So we were very cold, and the people knew winter was coming and feared the cold. And on a sunny day, the people could feel the warmth of the sun and wish that they could have some of that sun to keep them warm all through the winter, but we did not, because the sun did not always shine every day in the winter. Well, Coyote overheard the people's wish to keep part of the sun, and Coyote felt sorry that the people had no fur like him to keep warm. And Coyote thought maybe he could help the people. He knew where the fire beings lived, far away, high up in the mountains. The fire beings were keeping warm with fires. The fire beings were selfishly not sharing the fire. They kept it to themselves. So Coyote thought maybe he could get some of that fire for the people. But he couldn't do it alone. He needed help. He needed all the animals to help him. So he asked the animals, and all the other animals said yes, they would help. The animals said they would wait along the mountain path for the time when Coyote needed help. All he had to do was call to them, and they would be ready to help. So Coyote climbed to the mountaintop where the fire beings guarded the flames, and he hid in the bushes. But the fire beings looked, and they saw him in the bushes, and they said, oh, it's only a coyote. So they paid Coyote no mind. And the night wore on. And as the night wore on, the fire beings fell asleep, and Coyote snuck over to where the fire was and took a glowing ember and started to run down the mountain carrying that glowing ember. But the fire beings awoke and they said, "Someone is stealing our fire." So they started to race after Coyote and they grabbed the tip of his tail. And where they grabbed it, Coyote's tail fur turned white. And to this day, the tip of a coyote's tail is still white. As the fire beings continued to chase him down the mountain to get the ember back, Coyote called out to Squirrel and tossed the ember to him. Squirrel caught the ember and continued running down the mountain. The beings breathed fire, which caught the back of Squirrel's tail, and it curled up. And to this day, a squirrel's tail is still curved up. Squirrel continued running, and he called out to Chipmunk, and he tossed Chipmunk the ember, and Chipmunk caught it and continued running down the mountain, and the fire beings reached out, and they scratched their claws on Chipmunk's back, leaving three stripes that to this day remain on a chipmunk's back. As the beings got closer, Chipmunk called to Frog and tossed him the ember. Frog caught it and hopped as fast as he could, continuing down the mountain. But the being grabbed Frog's tail and pulled it clean off, so that to this day, frogs have no tails. But Frog continued hopping as fast as he could until he reached the bottom of the mountain. And when he did, Frog tossed the ember into wood and hopped away. Well, the fire beings tried and tried to get that ember out of the wood to no avail. So they gave up and went back up the mountain to leave the people alone forever. Now, the people saw that ember in the wood, and they knew the ember was there, but they did not know how to get it out, and the people did not know how to make fire. But Coyote knew, so he taught the people how to rub two sticks together to get a flame and use wood to make that flame grow. This way, the people could have fire to not only keep warm, but also to cook their food. And to this day, this is how people make fire. And so we thank Coyote when we see him, as he is often skillful and clever. So that's the story of how Coyote brought fire from the mountaintop to the people. Monsieur Clark, he called Coyote Prairie Wolf, since Coyote lives in the prairie. But no, Coyote also lives in the grasslands and the forest, as well as in the Rocky Mountains.
That is fantastic. And so your people, are they afraid of the coyote? Or are they not afraid of him?
No, I would say that we are not afraid of Coyote. Like I said, sometimes Coyote can be a trickster and he can do bad things. But sometimes, like this, he can be very wonderful.
Gosh, what an amazing story. So now the journey continues, and it is now time to cross the Rocky Mountains. What can you tell me about that? Were the Rocky Mountains anything like the mountains that you grew up in?
Well, the Bitterroot Mountains are part of the Rocky Mountains, so it wasn't a surprise to me. But these men had never seen that many mountains, and so large. It was overwhelming to them. The snow was so high up to your, past your knees, depending on how tall you were, and we had to walk through this. It was hard, and it was so cold. The snow was so cold. We just continued traveling, but it was hard because the ground was so icy that even some of the horses could not get up. So they had to take some of the supplies off of the horses and carry them, and just because the horse carrying the supplies and the people. So it took a long time to cross the mountains. Now, the Nez Perce said that we should wait till the snow melts, but they didn't want to. They wanted to go ahead. So they started, but then they couldn't get across. And so they realized that the Nez Perce were right, that we had to wait for the snow to melt before.
So did you ever actually make it across the Rocky Mountains and make it to the ocean?
Well, the plan was to cross the mountains, and Monsieur Clark said that Great Father Jefferson was looking for something that they called the Northwest Passage, which was a waterway that would lead through the mountains to the Pacific instead of having to climb the mountains. But that did not exist. And so Old Toby, who was the Shoshone that my brother gave as a guide, he helped us make it across the mountains. And once we made it across the mountains, he said the ocean was 12 days away. So we were traveling by water, and the water was very rough with terrible waves, and it started raining. And it rained for, I don't even know, it seemed like it rained forever. It just kept raining. And they wanted to get to the ocean so that we could get some of the salt to save meat with the salt. And also we heard that there was a monstrous fish there, but it would take 12 days or 5 days, I don't know. And so Monsieur Lewis and Monsieur Clark, we kept going, and we finally did make it because we could hear the ocean, the thunder of the ocean. It was so loud. And so we made camp, and Monsieur Lewis and Monsieur Clark were going to take some men to go there to see the monstrous fish. And they said I couldn't go. And that was another time that I actually did speak up. Because, as you know, I tried to stay silent. But I told them I did not think it was right that I come all this way and I do not get to see the ocean and the monstrous fish. Because it was going to take several days to walk there. But they said I could go. So I got to go and see the ocean. And it was larger than any river I had ever seen. And the fish, the bones were bigger than canoes and bigger than their biggest boats, but it was just bones that were picked clean of all the meat by that time of other people or animals. But the bones showed how big this monstrous fish was. It was amazing.
Did they call this fish a whale?
I think they did. I just called it a monstrous fish because it was so big.
Okay, keep going.
So we stayed near the ocean through the winter, and they built another fort, Fort Clatsop, that they named after the people there. And winter was so long. And that's when the Nez Perce, who were helping us, they said it would be better to wait to go back and cross the mountains until the snow melts. But they wanted to go home. So we started to go back, but it was not good. There was too much snow and ice. And so we went back and stayed with the Nez Perce through the winter. And while we were there, that's when Pomp got sick. He was getting teeth and he was very hot and he had a swollen neck. And they put this thing called a poultice of onions on his neck. I don't think it helped. But as time passed, he got better. But that was part of the best time we were there with the Nez Perce, because even though it was cold, all the white men and the Nez Perce played a game they called tag, because we couldn't do anything. And they also had foot races. And that man played the thing. He played that instrument, the fiddle. And there was dancing. And they were telling stories. And I told riddles. It was the best time.
I'd love to hear one of these riddles if you have one.
Oh, okay. Now, these riddles are something in nature. The answer is always something in nature.
Okay.
So I will ask you, and then you guess.
Okay.
What is a blue bowl filled with popcorn? Now, it's not an actual blue bowl filled with real popcorn. The answer is something in nature.
Okay, you got to tell me. I can't guess.
The sky filled with clouds.
Ah. Do you have another one?
Yes. Okay. Remember, the answer is something in nature. What is born in the forest but lives in the river?
Okay, I don't know.
A canoe.
A canoe.
Because it's made out of wood that you get out of the forest, and it lives in the river. Wait, one more riddle.
Go ahead.
This is a good one. What animal is stronger than all the others? Stronger than all the other animals.
I'm going to say the bear. Grizzly bear.
No, that was a trick question. It's not a grizzly bear. It's a skunk. Have you ever seen a skunk?
Oh, I have seen a skunk too close.
And what does a skunk do that makes people run away?
They are very strong, we'll say that. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, that was such a good time. And then on one of our last nights, the Nez Perce put some fir trees on fire as a way to ask for good weather for our journey back after we had seen the ocean.
When you first saw the ocean, what did you feel?
My heart stopped. First of all, it was so loud. The water was going up and down, and it made, they called them waves. And it was so powerful. You could see it pushing stones and trees. It was so powerful, and it was so loud. And also, the ocean had salt. If you put your hand in it and taste it, it tastes salty. You could look at it, and it kept going and going. It never stopped. I wondered what was on the other side. Like, where did it end? Or did it never end? I don't know.
Did anyone go into the ocean?
People did go down there and they put their feet or they touched it. They had to go down there because they wanted to collect some of the water to get the salt so that we could put it on the meat to save the meat.
As we talk about the ocean and I think about this journey as a whole, there was one time where I read, this just reminds me of that, and I haven't asked you about it. There was one time I read that you were going through, you were crossing some river and all the boats tipped over and you almost lost everything. When did that happen in this journey?
That happened at the beginning of the journey. That wasn't at the end of the journey. I was on this boat and my husband was, he had this big stick that he put in and he was sort of steering the boat. And my husband, he was not, how do I say this? He was not a boatman. He was not good with boats.
His feet belonged on the ground.
Yes, I guess you could say that his feet belonged on the ground. And also, Charbonneau could not swim. So one time when we were on the Missouri River, the river, I think we were going against the tide. Do you know what that means? Like the river's going this way, but we're going the opposite way. So it was very hard to paddle the boat. And the wind was so strong. And Charbonneau was supposed to be steering the boat, but all of a sudden the wind was so strong, he was afraid and the boat started to tip. And Charbonneau just cried out to his God for mercy. And the boat started to tip and the cargo fell in the river. And one man pointed a gun at Charbonneau and told him, hold that boat steady or he will shoot him. Oh my gosh, that was very scary. And other men were trying to right the boat, but it was filling with water because it was tipping to the side and the water was up to my waist. And so I have my baby and I'm holding my baby and all of a sudden their supplies start to fall in the river. And they were in some sort of watertight bags. There were some of their books and their tools and their maps. And so I'm holding my son and I'm reaching out into the boat, into the water, and I'm just grabbing some of their supplies because I knew that they needed them and that they wanted to keep them. And so I grabbed as many supplies as I could and put them back in the boat. And eventually the men righted the boat and they took the water out of the boat. And eventually we went to the shore to make our camp for the night. And everybody was wet. Everything was wet. So we spent the next few days drying everything out. And at that moment, I think Charbonneau lost the respect of all the men. They were not happy with him doing that. So he tried to gain back their respect because he was actually a very good cook. He cooked in, he called it the French style, and he made this thing called boudin blanc, which was a bison sausage that tasted good. And everybody, they liked his cooking. The men didn't like Charbonneau, but they liked his cooking. And so we dried everything out. That was, we had adventures like that. There was also the time at the, when we were at the Great Falls, when it was raining and raining and raining, and we were climbing this mountain, and all of a sudden there was, I guess you could call it like a flood, a flash flood that just started. And I was there with my baby, and oh my goodness, it was awful. There was such this flood, the water just kept coming. And I can't remember if it was Monsieur Lewis or Mr. Clark. It was the water just started to come up and the sky turned gray and there was terrible rain with ice falling from the sky. And the ground at our feet was just muddy and there were rocks and giant stones and tree trunks that just kept coming. And we were at the Great Falls and the raging waters came up to our waist. It was so strong. It was pushing us towards the falls. And if it pushed us towards the fall, we could go over the falls. Well, Monsieur Clark, he pushed me and Pomp out of the ravine and he pushed me up this slippery rock ledge just in time as the water filled the gully where we were. And then rocks and boulders and trees were just coming down there. He pushed me up there or else we would have gone to our death down the falls. That's where I got sick. I was very sick. I had violent stomach pain and I was very hot and they made me bleed. I don't know why they did that. They said it would make me feel better, but it did not help.
Who made you bleed?
Monsieur Lewis, he was like the medicine man. He would do things. And so since I was so sick, they cut me and made me bleed. And they said that would make me feel better. I didn't really understand that. It didn't help. But eventually they gave me some water from a sulfur spring, and I started to feel better. I started to feel much, much better.
Water from a sulfur spring sounds yes. like terrible smelling and tasting water.
I hadn't been able to eat. I don't know if it was just that eventually, when you get sick, eventually it stops. If there's something that's in you and it passes.
But after you had sulfur water, things got better.
It did.
Okay, well, I
felt better.
Wow, what an adventure. You know, when you were telling me the story about where you jumped out of the boat and Charbonneau lost all respect from the men, which I guess all that respect went your direction when you saved all the supplies and the journals. Those journals exist today.
Oh.
They exist today because of what you did. They wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you.
Well, it was funny because Monsieur Lewis and Monsieur Clark were so thankful to me that they named a nearby waterway after me. They called it Sacagawea River or something to that. They were always doing that. They were naming places that already had names and writing it down on their maps and their papers. And they gave things new names. Places already had names, but they named something after me. They also named this giant rock structure after my son. They called it Pompey's Tower. They named something after him.
Did, well, with Pompey having his nickname of Pomp, and they gave him Pompey, did they give you a nickname?
Actually, only Clark. Monsieur Clark, he called me Janie. I don't know.
Janie?
Janie.
Janie, really?
Yes.
Did you like that name?
I don't know. I guess it was showing affection because he showed affection for me because he really liked my son. I think I don't know if he really liked Charbonneau, but he knew that we were a package deal, so.
He tolerated him.
And so that's why, you know, he wanted us to come where we are now. That's why he wanted us to come to St. Louis.
So at least for the time being, it sounds like these high-level expeditions and adventures are on pause for a little bit. What is your life like now in St. Louis?
It's very strange. I am trying to be like the white people because that's who's here. So I am trying to be like them.
One could argue that as you look through your life, over a very short number of years, you just pass through one set of rules to the next set of rules, and you just try to fit in. The Shoshone lived a certain way, and then you describe the Hidatsus lived an entirely different way, and then they throw you in with this husband, and then he has a set of rules. And of course, now you're trying to acclimate to the city life of St. Louis and the rules that they live by there. And I think that maybe, as I look at you, I think that you are probably the great survivor of all great survivors, because you find a way to make do with what you have wherever you are.
Well, what choice do I have? Time has passed. Pomp is four winters. Charbonneau had Pomp have this thing called baptized in this thing they call a church where they put water on his head. And Charbonneau is planning to farm. This is nothing like he's ever done before. Not living near the mountains and hunting and trapping animals and trading. I don't know. I don't know, but I am trying. I am trying to live like that, but it is so different and it's hard. And as it has been since I left my family, I am lonely. I long to hear my language, but I do as I am told. And I don't know if we will go back. Charbonneau will tell me what he wants to do for us all.
Well, as you are looking for the people that speak your language and the people that care about you, as difficult as your life has been, I will leave you on this note, and that is that in our time, you are so respected as a survivor and an adventurer and a courageous person. And I've really enjoyed this conversation with you. And I was wondering if there's anything you'd like to say before we finish.
I don't know. I am surprised that in your time, I matter at all. Because I just feel like most of my life, I have not mattered. I guess that gives me a sense of peace. I just hope that the Shoshone of your time don't think badly of me, that they don't think that I betrayed my people, because I did not. I had no choices. I did what I had to do, as you said, to survive.
I am so thankful for your time today, and I wish you the best.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you listening to my story, because as I said, no one has ever, they really never asked me of my story. So I thank you for giving me the chance to speak and for you to listen and especially share my thoughts with the world.
When I finished this conversation, I was so sad because I didn't know Sacagawea's life was absolutely tragic. Despite all of her courage and ingenuity, she was passed around from one group of men to the next. She was kidnapped, sold, and forced to travel across the newly acquired, uncharted piece of our nation with a newborn baby in her arms and literally had no power to choose the path that her life would be. Yet despite these odds, she overcame. She survived. She demonstrated a kind of bravery and courage that is admired to this day by all people that know her story. Her son, Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau, or Pomp, was in fact educated by William Clark in St. Louis, as she'd mentioned. Later, Pomp moved in with a German prince when he was 18 years old and learned to speak four different languages. Having been the child that traveled with the explorers west to the Pacific Ocean, he had lifelong celebrity status. But what happened to his mother? We're not quite sure. She either died very young or very old. Nonetheless, she continues to be an inspiration for all of us, that despite our circumstances, even those with no power are still capable of immense bravery and extraordinary achievement. Thank you for listening, and don't forget that when you subscribe or tell a friend about the Calling History podcast, a random group of garden gnomes in Idaho come to life and stage elaborate reenactments of their favorite 80s movies. I'm Tony Dean, and until next time, I'm History.